This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
East Central America, where the palms sway, the sun blazes fierce, melting hope away. Mexico City feels like fire. North Africa heat waves burn out desire. Middle East people struggle to work out the day, to sleep in a hot night. India streets shimmer in a fever. China people duck out of hot streets, whose clothes business shrinks. Things break down. Power plants are on overdrive, putting more carbon in the sky.
Tornadoes, killer heat domes, and tipping points, we have it all for you this week. Climate scientist Paul Beckwith and I cover the latest climate news and science destabilizing the world. How, why, and when? Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It is one world, one hot world.
Why did the world just get hotter? Are there more tornadoes? Is something dangerous lurking in extreme weather? No one covers the big picture science and news like Paul Beckwith. Beckwith is a Canadian climate scientist. He taught that in universities. Then he became the world's biggest YouTube climate science weather teacher. From Ottawa, Canada, Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for inviting me, Alex. It's always a pleasure to come on your program.
Well, let's start with hot news that isn't in the news. Mexico and all of Central America have been stuck for weeks under the most oppressive heat dome ever. Crazy heat records were shattered there for both days and for nighttime temperatures. People are just trying to survive it, and some do not. What do you make of this, Paul?
Yes, we're already setting lots of temperature records around the planet. You know, it's not even summer yet. I mean, we're just in spring, and we're getting record temperatures that would set records even in the middle of the summer in some places. So, you know, Mexico in particular, yeah, tremendous heat waves, and you can tell that it's sort of hasn't been this hot for so long because, you know, the wildlife is really suffering. And the big story in the news the last couple of days is the what they call howler monkeys that are falling out of the trees dead, hundreds of them literally in several places in Mexico. Some of them, you know, people are getting very concerned and they're going out trying to put water under some of the trees in the forest, et cetera. I mean, it's basically heat stroke. And these gorgeous creatures are just dropping dead. I mean, literally dropping out of the trees. Like, it's crazy.
Well, monkeys are quite a bit like us, actually, so that should be a bit of a warning sign. And it reminds me of the stories when there was a huge heat dome in Australia and both bats and birds literally fell out of the sky dead on the ground, like littering the ground. So these are hard times for the species, too.
Yeah. I mean, the heat waves in Australia have done this, and also I remember the fires from just a few years ago. I mean, there were some stories or research indicating, you know, we're talking about different, you know, not millions of creatures, but literally billions of creatures from those massive wildfires in Australia several years back. And of course, we've had the massive wildfires in Canada last year, and it's early. We're not even into summer yet, and we're getting record numbers of fires already exceeding what we had last year. So, and in terms of hectares burned, I think there were something like, 18.5 million hectares of forest, which is about 4 or 5 times the average year. So we're there, and then other places, of course, are experiencing these massive floods, torrential rains leading to floods. And you know, right now, it's been a very active tornado season in the U.S. Particularly. And, you know, we just have, you know, just a day or two ago, we had a massive tornado go through some towns in Iowa and, you know, with lots of fatalities and just horrendous damage. I mean, these are big storms, very, very high winds. We seem to get clusters of tornadoes and they seem to be, you know, there seems to be a lot more more widespread. They don't kind of confine to Tornado Alley like they used to in decades past. They were very predominant in this region, you know, which then became called Tornado Alley. But it seems like they're distributed more widely, and the wind speeds are increasing. And, a meteorologist friend of mine just sent me some data, Doppler radar data, showing that the winds in some of these tornadoes hit record high levels and, you know, way above the, we use what is called the enhanced Fujita scale, EF1, EF5, et cetera. And this is well beyond the EF5 limit. So, you know, like, you know, I've often talked about having to upgrade, you know, the tornado category or the hurricane categories and have a category 6 hurricane. And I think we may have to do the same thing on the enhanced Fujita scale, the EF tornado scale as well. So yeah, it's crazy times with all these extreme weather events.
Yes, you got in on this Twister Mania feature early, doing a video on it on May 11th, and 2 weeks later the tornadoes keep coming, flattening little places like Greenville, Ohio. The strange thing with all the news coverage, and there's lots of juicy footage because there's so many storm chasers out there with good cameras, we think there must be more tornadoes now with climate change, except a recent study shows that may not be true, at least not so far. How can we see so many tornadoes, and yet they're not technically increasing year on year in numbers?
Well, yes, I mean, there's a lot of different factors, you know, with tornadoes. I mean, we get quite a few in Canada, but, you know, you wouldn't know that because a lot of them happen in remote areas, you know, forests where they're not even documented or recorded. But there is something called the Northern Tornadoes Project, which is collecting more information on Canadian tornadoes. But it seems like, it just makes sense to me that if we're creating a more energetic atmosphere, which we are by, you know, increased temperatures, you get more evaporation, more water vapor in the atmosphere. That water vapor rises, convectively rises, and you get condensing into water droplets, which then collide with each other and combine and so on. The whole energetics of the atmosphere have changed. You know, we have more energy in the atmosphere, so it just stands to reason that there would be some effect to tornadoes, not necessarily in the number, because you still need a trigger for these things. But I think there's a sort of a clustering. So when there's outbreaks of tornadoes, I think we're getting more in short durations of time in specific regions. I think we're also getting a clustering towards more powerful tornadoes occurring concurrently rather than, you know, the odd sporadic one. So I think the statistics need to be looked at carefully. Also, you know, we definitely seem to be getting a shift. As I mentioned, it's not just, you know, if you will, Tornado Alley may be shifting east and northward as well from where it traditionally has been. So we're definitely seeing these effects, but I mean, the science needs to, you know, be firmed up on this. There is some studies that are showing, you know, different things. As you say, some are showing that we're not getting more tornadoes, but I think those same studies will show that we're getting more intense tornadoes, and they're happening in regions where they didn't happen so much before. I think those things are true with the tornadoes.
Right, and they found that there were fewer tornado days, so fewer days in which tornadoes occurred, but far more clustering. So in the days where they did occur, there were a lot of them, and that's exactly what we're seeing, and more chance they will hit something. And recently, a powerful straight-line wind called a derecho blew out windows in downtown Houston, Texas. Major Texas power systems were down. Their transmission towers were just blown apart like little sticks, just as another triple-digit heat wave arrived. Do you think that violent weather is connected to the giant heat dome over Mexico next door? I mean, they separated in the news. They show America, and then there really is nothing north of the 49th parallel. There is no Canada, and they don't talk about Mexico either. But it's got to be connected.
Yes, I think these things are definitely connected. I mean, the derechos you know, I would wager that most people wouldn't have even heard of that word 5 years ago. Basically, we're getting these large frontal storms. When we get cold fronts, usually it's cold fronts where, you know, cold air is denser than warm air. So if a cold front is where the cold air is advancing on warm air and it gets underneath and wedges up, you know, forces up the warm air. So if the warm air is laden with water vapor, then that water vapor condenses and you get a whole line of storms, and these storms can then generate the straight line winds, the derechos, and they're moving, you know, they can be moving at quite fast speeds past the region. So, you know, we had a very, very powerful derecho almost 2 years ago to the day, 2 years ago to last week, in the area just southwest of Ottawa, which brought down huge numbers of trees and took roofs off houses and so on. And I drive through that region occasionally when I visit family in Oshawa and Oakville from Ottawa, so just along Highway 7 there, and there's regions. I mean, it's interesting because when it occurred a couple of years ago, I filmed some videos of the damage, and I revisited a year after the derecho, and I'll do another one next time I'm in that part neck of the woods, so to speak, just to see what sort of recovery there is from such an event that brings down a huge swath of trees. You know, all of these storms, more energetic storms, are a direct result of the warming, which, as I said, increases the evaporation from any water bodies, lakes, rivers, etc. More water vapor in the atmosphere, which then is convectively lifted and condenses into water droplets, releasing energy. So storm chasers and meteorologists are well aware of the term called CAPE, which stands for convective available potential energy. It's sort of the potential energy that could be converted into kinetic energy when these storms trigger. And those numbers seem to be increasing and be high for longer time periods, you know, sort of cluster days when you're likely to get more tornadoes happening on a tornado day, you know, whereas for the energy to build up, you know, maybe it's not increasing. As you said, there's less tornado days, but when there are tornadoes on a day, there's a lot more storms on that given day. You know, the energy in the atmosphere is definitely, you know, exhibiting behavior which didn't happen before. And then, of course, there's also, you know, the guiding of these storms and things, which depends a lot on the jet streams. And we've often, you know, talked a lot I've often talked a lot about the jet streams getting slower and wavier and stuck in place because of the greatly warming temperatures in the Arctic, the phenomenon called Arctic temperature amplification, where the Arctic's warming 5 to 7 times faster than lower latitudes. You know, we can look at individual events like tornadoes or individual storms, but it's always good to keep in mind the big picture of the global patterns like the jet streams and so on.
Yes, in an interview last fall, top scientist Kevin Trenberth said he thinks global warming has more impact now on world weather than the mighty El Niño-La Niña cycle called ENSO. So we're in system override. What do you think, and where are we in that ENSO cycle?
Yes, well, of course, the ENSO-El Niño-Southern Oscillation, you know, it's a cycle that involves both the atmosphere and the oceans, right? We think of, for the El Niños, the ocean temperatures in the equatorial regions, especially the East Equatorial Pacific off South America, getting very, very warm water, and then that, of course, feeds back into atmospheric patterns, and, you know, we basically get a period of time with the El Niños where there's heat coming out of the oceans, so the atmosphere gets a greater proportion of the heat, and then that reverses with the La Niña, and, you know, we seem to be, this cycle has been going on for a long period of time, these ENSO cycles, and, you know, people talk about it as climate variability and so on, but on top of these cycles, of course, is the overall warming from climate change itself, or global warming, which, according to James Hansen's research, which is you know, I think he's got a better handle on what's going on than most other scientists. And, you know, he's some people consider him a bit out of the mainstream with some of his work. But he's basically saying global warming has accelerated greatly since 2010. From 1970 to 2010, we were warming about 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade. Since 2010, we're warming between, his numbers were between a band of 50% to 100% increase in warming rate, which would be 0.27 to 0.36 degrees Celsius per decade. The observations since 2010 show we're right pegged at 0.36, which is double what we were, the warming rate, and he's expecting that to, you know, continue, and he's attributing that to a lot of that acceleration to a decrease of sulfur, both from China and from international commercial ships that ply the ocean. So the International Maritime Organization put very stringent restrictions on the sulfur content of shipping fuels in 2015, and they tightened that in 2020. I know in 2020 it was 3.5% sulfur content down to 0.5% sulfur content. So as a result, the sulfur, when these ships ply the ocean and burn the fossil fuels, burn the ship diesel, the sulfur is put into the atmosphere and it creates low-level clouds because it forms sulfur dioxide, which is an excess cloud condensation nuclei. So we get these low-level clouds over the ocean, which then causes the cooling effect. But without the sulfur, you don't get the low-level clouds, you don't get the cooling effect. So he's saying that this is why global warming has greatly accelerated. And there have been, interestingly, in the last few months, there's been some independent authors that aren't connected with Hansen that are basically looking at China's sulfur emissions and also looking at shipping emissions and coming to the same conclusions that he is. But this is not mainstream science yet, I would say. You know, there will still need to be further studies to corroborate this, but I think, I'm pretty sure that Hansen's correct.
His latest post on his Columbia University website is titled Comments on Global Warming Acceleration Sulfur Emissions Observations. That was posted May 16th, 2024. I'll put links to all that in my blog at ecoshock.org. But I have to say, and you've pointed out, other scientists disagree with Hansen, saying shipping emissions alone are not enough to explain the strange increase in heat. And some, like Kevin Trenberth, point to the buildup of heat in the oceans. Would you like to talk to us about ocean heat waves, Paul?
It's quite well known in the climate community, at least, and, you know, I think more public awareness is occurring. Like, most of the heat, I mean, over 90% of the heat that's trapped is warming up the oceans. It's heating up the oceans. Most noticeably, I guess, is the sea surface temperatures. The temperature of the oceans in the top layers, you know, in the surface layers. But that heat is also penetrating deep down into the oceans. And we're seeing effects of that heat, especially in the southern hemisphere, with the water deeper down greatly heating. And that water infiltrates underneath the ice covering mostly West Antarctic ice sheets. So it goes underneath there, and it's melting the ice from below. It's putting a lot of stress on the big, huge ice sheets and ice shells. And that's a big concern. And, you know, also the warming oceans have greatly reduced the amount of Antarctic sea ice that is forming around the continent, extending out vast distances in the winters and then melting right back. And we're getting, you know, we may end up having that so-called blue ocean event where we lose, you know, we have less than a million square kilometers of sea ice. That may actually occur in the southern hemisphere first rather than the northern hemisphere. There's a couple other factors, you know, wild cards in the climate system, if you like, related to the global, you know, the global tipping points, I guess you could call them. And the big one is the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, ocean currents, because that has slowed significantly over the last number of decades, and there are various early warning signals that indicate that that may be fast approaching a tipping point.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Paul Beckwith, the Canadian climate scientist, and we're talking about the big picture of what's happening on this planet. All right, you just talked about AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, which most of us call the Gulf Stream. And even careful scientists like Stefan Ramstorff of the Potsdam Institute are loudly worrying about AMOC. And with AMOC and a lot of other natural systems, and as you've said in your YouTube videos, we need to learn a key idea called critical slowdown. What is that, and how does it work before something really bad happens?
So if you look at any data set, any Earth system data set, there's noise on top of the signal. So you get this curve, and there's this noise, which is exhibited as sort of a high-frequency fluctuation in the data, you know, spikes up and down, you know, very high frequency. So there's, you know, they're very close together. And then what you see with this critical slowing down is the system loses resilience. It doesn't respond as quickly. So when there's a spike up, it doesn't come down as quickly. When there's a spike down, it doesn't recover to the average as quickly. So you get a change in the frequency of the spikes. The spikes are further apart in time. And that's indicating often that the system is becoming kind of brittle and less resilient. And this often happens as an early warning signal, if you like, before the system flips into a different state, before there's a large change in the signal to a different state. So the AMOC, the ocean currents that are being measured at various latitudes by many different types of instruments, shipborne instruments. There's these Argo floats in the ocean, which are autonomous floats. There's various ways that we're measuring things, and we're seeing very worrying signs in this. These so-called early warning signals or critical slowing down of frequency, which doesn't mean for sure that we're going to reach a tipping point, but if we are, you know, sometimes a tipping point could occur without these signals. Sometimes these signals will appear and the system doesn't tip, but, you know, so it's not foolproof. It's not 100%, but often systems that are about to tip do show these characteristics. And we're seeing this with the AMOC, and I call the AMOC sort of the mother of all tipping points, because there's so many other things that are related. And we do know, actually, a paper came out not too long ago that was arguing that we probably would have lost, you know, we may have already had a blue ocean event in the Arctic if the AMOC hadn't been slowing down as much as it has. We may have had much greater melt rates on Greenland if the AMOC hadn't been slowing down as much as it has. I mean, we're talking about a 20 or 30% drop over several decades in the AMOC. So where does that heat go? It doesn't just disappear. So what that means is the AMOC slows down, the northern hemisphere, the polar region, the Arctic basically cools, or doesn't heat as much as it would otherwise, and there's more heat at the equator, and there's more heat buildup in the southern hemisphere. Well, the heat buildup at the equator changes the monsoons, which are very important for agriculture, you know, for feeding billions of people that live in those regions. So this is a huge concern, because if this whole band of rainfall called the ITCZ, or Intertropical Convergence Zone, if this actually this would actually shift southward if the AMOC continued to slow down, and the monsoons would actually occur over oceans, less more over the oceans in the tropics and less over the land. So this would impact perhaps the food ability to grow food for literally billions of people. And then, of course, the southern hemisphere, you know, warms a lot more, and we're actually seeing that already with the decline of Antarctic sea ice. So there's a very concerning overall picture that could be emerging here, you know, as the AMOC continues to slow down and eventually, you know, reach the point where it could just tip and shut off.
Well, with critical slowdown, I wonder if this quiet before the storm in systems theory applies to our current climate times. I mean, governments proclaim a climate emergency but still approve more fossil fuels anyway. Paul, do you believe in social tipping points, as some people in Cambridge and other places do?
Yes. So this is the whole area which is talked about greatly in this pretty extensive report put out in December of last year, December of 2023, by Tim Lenton is, I think, one of the lead authors. It's by the University of Exeter. The report, you could just Google, it's called Global Tipping Points 2023, and I did an extensive coverage of things in this report in my videos, and they talk about Earth system tipping points, which, you know, we know of the AMOC, the Amazon rainforest, tipping over from forest to savanna or grasslands, and tipping points for Greenland ice and Antarctic ice and so on. So those are the bad tipping points, if you like, or they're, we call them negative tipping points. The language is important because when we talk about feedbacks, like a negative feedback is a slowing feedback, and the positive feedback is an accelerating feedback. So, you know, if we're talking about changes in Earth systems, positive feedbacks are bad. Right? Negative feedbacks are good. But so the language is confusing. So they, this report goes and they talk about positive tipping points as being good for us and negative tipping points being the bad ones, like the Earth system ones. So the idea of positive tipping points is what humans can do. Like, we do have some agency, right? We have the ability to change things. So some positive tipping points are, for example, solar power generation, wind power, better battery technology, electric cars, you know, although surely we're not talking about replacing 1.5 billion cars on the planet that are internal combustion with electric. I mean, surely we can be smart and maybe only produce 10% of the cars because, you know, your car and my car sits in the garage for 90-95% of the time, right? So we need to change the way we do things, not necessarily replace what we have, but do it in a smarter fashion. So all of these sort of ideas, you know, political action, government, you know, I used to think, well, government subsidizing fossil fuels is, you know, is the horrible thing that we need to stop. But it's actually worse than that because many fossil fuel companies, in fact, over half in the world, I believe, are actually owned by governments. They're national companies owned by the government. So it's not that the government's subsidizing. The government owns the company and is running the big oil company, you know. And so, you know, they're basically shooting their citizens in the foot by doing this because there's no, it's all short-term thinking, profits, et cetera, as opposed to, you know, having a viable planet in the near-term future. So, like, even ideas of people, the number of people that are suddenly concerned about climate change demanding action by governments, you know, you can talk about those numbers, you know, once they pass sort of a critical threshold, you know, there'd be 10% or 15% of the population or whatever. But if you cross a threshold, then you can maybe have a tipping point. And, you know, I guess we'll know that things have changed when I often talk about the U.S. military budget. You know, if we took that for a year or two and applied it to trying to save the planet, you know, trying to advance some of these positive tipping point things, saying the enemy is not really any other nation. The enemy is, you know, our planet is working to kick humanity off, basically. Right? So trying to address that by large scales, I mean, we've got lots of engineers and scientists working for the military-industrial complex. If they applied their knowledge and skills and training to trying to save the planet, trying to ensure that humanity can stay on the planet given abrupt climate system emergency, then, you know, then we know that maybe governments are starting to be serious. But yeah, they still own the oil companies. It's not just the subsidies, but many governments own the actual companies.
Yes, we're talking about Saudi Arabia and Iran and Norway, but you know, Canada and Australia and the United States are major fossil fuel producers, and it's a very complicated subject.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. We are chewing our way through big news in climate science and extreme disasters unfolding around the world. Last week, I spoke with journalist and author Gwen Dyer about Earth intervention. And I remember talking with you, Paul, years ago when you were ready to try spraying sulfates over the Arctic, trying to save the sea ice. Do you think we need geoengineering now to save a livable climate?
Yes, and the Exeter article kind of skirts around, you know, one aspect of geoengineering, so-called geoengineering. I mean, we need to really separate it. The governments around the world are fully pushing for carbon dioxide removal or carbon removal from the atmosphere. So, you know, whenever they talk about net zero, they're talking about the carbon that goes up into the atmosphere minus the carbon that's removed from the atmosphere, and they have fantasies or hopes, or they assume that we'll have technologies that can take vast amounts of CO2 and methane out of the atmosphere, you know, at some point within the next couple of decades. So whenever they talk about net zero, this is what they're implying, so carbon removal from the atmosphere without actually saying it. Right, so that's half of the geoengineering coin, if you like. And then, of course, the other half is to block some sunlight so that the planet doesn't heat up and we don't, you know, lose the threat on the planet, basically. And, you know, that's called SRM, which sounds like an accountant came up with that name, solar radiation management. And I much prefer the term SOS, which stands for not just save our souls, but solar optimization systems or solar optimizing strategies. And these ideas include things like iron fertilization of the ocean to stimulate phytoplankton blooms to capture more carbon, solar aerosol injection. I think SAI is the acronym often used, which is the idea of you can actually create by injecting sulfur into the stratosphere, you can block sunlight and cool the planet by a known amount, depending on how much you put up into the atmosphere. And it also, the sulfur, as I mentioned, acts as cloud condensation nuclei, generating, you can generate low-level clouds, which can cool the planet. So I think as controversial as this subject is, I can almost guarantee you that we will be doing this probably fairly soon, especially if the acceleration of the warming continues as it has been since 2010. So, you know, like it or not, it's going to come to our planet. I would be willing to bet a lot that's going to happen. So Gwen Dyer talks about the different methods that people have been thinking about, and he actually has his new book, Intervention Earth, and I was fortunate enough to actually meet him just a few weeks ago, because he came to the Ottawa International Book Festival and spoke about his book. And also Michael Mann has a book out, which, so he was also at the Writers Festival. So it was good to sort of see their different viewpoints.
Almost every week, scary new science reveals even more ways ice at both poles is under attack as the world warms. You've been specializing in this for decades. In February, you posted a video about the global reach of atmospheric rivers. So we hear about atmospheric rivers hitting the West Coast, like California or even Vancouver, but all the way to the poles?
Yes. You know, again, it comes back to the waviness of the jet streams. If there's a large temperature contrast between the poles and the equator, then the jet streams actually move fairly quickly, and they stay relatively straight. You know, they're not completely straight, but they circumvent the planet, and there's small waves, Rossby waves, in the jet stream behave in the jet stream patterns. But, of course, with the greatly warming Arctic and the slowing and increased waviness in the north-south, then, you know, the jet streams can become extremely, extremely wavy, you know, and the troughs of the waves can actually end up close to the equator at times, and the crest of these waves can extend up into the high Arctic. So the atmospheric rivers just kind of follow the path of these huge waves in the jet stream, and they can bring lots of moisture and warmth, for example, up into the Arctic at times. You know, and when that happens, of course, it tends to equalize temperatures with latitude. So, you know, a jet stream that's extending far south and extending far north almost up to the North Pole brings warm air to the north and it brings cold air to the south, so it tends to try to equalize temperature with latitude. But then also there's the AMOC wild card, right? Because if the AMOC actually shuts off, the Arctic will get very cold again. And in fact, Western Europe will drop temperatures significantly. Parts of Norway, northern Scandinavia, will be extremely cold. Mean average temperatures much, much lower than now. And during winters, the sea ice could extend all the way across the Arctic, almost over to Northern Europe, if the AMOC shuts off. So we've got that wild card.
Just a point, though, about the global reach of atmospheric rivers. When they get to the poles, two things. First of all, we started getting reports just a few years ago from scientists in research stations way up high on the ice in Greenland saying, hey, it's raining here. It's raining all across Greenland, and that never happens this time of year. And second, the impact on the winter formation of sea ice. Tell us about that.
Yeah, exactly. So we get all of these type of effects, and I mean, of course, you know, the rain is devastating. You know, the warm water flows across the ice, causing tremendously rapid melt. It gets rid of the fresh snow layers, which are very highly reflective, right? Very, very white, very high albedo, reflecting sunlight, keeping the Arctic colder, of course, when the sun is out. So this is in Arctic summers. But it also exposes the debris and dirt and material, you know, ash, whatever, that's sitting on top of, that's within the ice. So, you know, it lowers the albedo that way as well. And, of course, it ensures that any sea ice that does form is actually very thin and then can melt out that much quicker in the summer. So all of these sort of effects are kind of feeding into each other. Yeah, we've had these atmospheric rivers bring temperatures to the North Pole well above zero in the middle of winter, for example, and the rain instead of snow. So it just changes everything. And then, of course, you've had to deal with them. You know, California's had to deal with the atmospheric rivers. And there was a period in the, 1860s or something when, you know, it basically rained for an entire month or more in California, and we got an inland lake forming in the Central Valley of California, which puts Sacramento 15 feet underwater, right? And then it took a year for that lake to evaporate out, more than a year. So that was atmospheric river based. So, you know, they've been around for a long time. Again, that's probably a fairly new term for people. You know, we didn't have that. Most people, you could have asked them a decade ago, what's an atmospheric river? They'd look at you with a blank stare, but the derecho and atmospheric river, all these different terms are haboobs, you know, dust storms, all of these different terms to describe weather events that were very rare before are becoming in the sort of general vernacular because they're happening more and more frequently.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. We're talking about the world. So these big changes on the planet are coming just too fast, and there's too many of them for our small brains to comprehend. We have specialists who find that bugs, bats, or frogs are disappearing, and forest experts worry the Amazon will not recover, changing rainfall across the world. We've got permafrost scientists getting hoarse, shouting about what's happening there. Ice people are alarmed. Do you have advice on how to cope with the fire hose of news about our shifting environment?
Well, I guess it's important for us to for our sort of emotional stability, to have outlets for sure, so we can kind of, you know, have hobbies or outlets or other things that we're passionate about to kind of distract us. But the idea of agency, I think, is very important. One of the worst feelings that any person can have is this feeling of helplessness, right? Like, well, I can't do anything, so, you know, it leads to sort of lethargy and interferes with functioning of your day-to-day life, right? So it's important to have some sort of sense of agency. So, you know, we all have different backgrounds, different training, different skill sets. So I think one of the keys is to figure out, okay, we're worried about the climate crisis. We'd like to make some sort of impact, even, you know, the very smallest impact, or at least feel we're doing something. So how can we apply our skill set, you know, which is different for every person, to doing something, you know, maybe going to joining your local climate activist group, going on a march protest or something, or, you know, starting a blog, or just sending, if you know, decision makers, if you know, politicians, somebody that you have, you're friends with or have some influence over, to get them more up to speed on the climate emergency, right? There's sort of many different things that we can. I think when we do these things, we shouldn't focus on results at all. I think we just do it because it's the right thing to do, and it does make us feel a bit more empowered. You know, whether or not it has any impact is, you know, that's something that we don't have so much control over, right?
I talk with scientists, of course, and you do, and we have charts and we have numbers, but we know the majority of people now sweating out the heat from fossil-powered society do not live in it. A recent guest talked about the millions of families in India living in rude houses with metal roofs. One study showed temperatures inside such shack houses can go up to 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 Celsius. So there's no shelter inside, there's no shelter outside, and for millions they've got no electricity or air conditioning either. I don't know how they stand it or what they think about it or how they will react as this goes on. Would you talk to us about your April video on the, quote, impacts of Earth tipping points on societal breakdown, radicalization, polarization, enemy, and wars? And you would have to define what enemy means and what that has to do with climate change. What was that video about, Paul?
Basically, this is a year, 2024, when we have lots of elections around the world. And what we're seeing sort of politically is we seem to be getting a tilt to more extreme right political leaders around the world and more extreme right points of view. Just look at Santos in Florida, I mean, trying to ban the concept of climate change. Well, climate change is not happening in Florida because I'm legislating that it doesn't happen in Florida. I mean, things like this, like, it's just like you kind of roll your eyes and say, well, you know, our society is going absolutely crazy. The idea, a lot of it comes to the things like migration of people, you know, is a key one, right? Because, you know, as things get worse, or as people's perception of global stability, global events worsens, and you think, you know, the world is becoming a lot more of a dangerous place, and countries sort of turn more inward, and they, you know, there becomes more pushed, you know, against immigration, for example, against, you know, letting people in from other places, and countries become more protectionist, and you know, so things tend to tilt more to you know, right wing governments and right wing policies. You know, I think climate is behind a lot of these changes. We know how climate can enable or increase the likelihood of scramble for resources, for fresh water, for food, you know, and those sort of things can lead to wars and conflicts. And, you know, I think the Syrian example is very good because we had, you know, record, you know, 1-in-1,000-year droughts for many years in a row in Syria, so people could no longer grow food. So farmers moved to the cities, no jobs, and, you know, political unrest and civil war. So climate droughts and famines and things can really, you know, trigger these sort of much wider geopolitical conflicts.
Well, it's not very radical to say that humans are shaped by their environment, and the environment is changing. So there you go. And, something strange I find is that the people most vocal about climate danger are either young or old. The climate activism is bubbling on campus. Young people do know, yet social media is filled with older activists, well, like you and certainly me. And the working generation in between seems trapped in debt, working for some corporation, keeping pretty quiet, hoping the whole thing doesn't collapse soon. And they stick to cars and diesel trucks even when their homes burn down or flood or blow away. It just makes you wonder, what will it take to get the average person into this battle, into the streets, into the voting booths, demanding emergency climate action? Do you know?
Well, I don't think we'll have to wait very long. You know, I think the disruptions that we're seeing and the acceleration of the global warming and the increases of extreme weather events and more climate catastrophes around the world, you know, I think it's going to hit, the weakness for human society, which is our global food supply, really, food and water supply. And, yeah, we're going to probably have jet stream configurations in the not-too-distant future where we get multiple failures in breadbaskets around in the Northern Hemisphere. So, you know, we greatly lose the ability to grow sufficient food to feed the planet for several years. And at least there is some sort of buffer because we waste, 30 to 40% of everything that we produce right now. And so if we have a shortfall of growing 30 to 40% of wheats and corns and whatever, you know, our basic, we'll be happy that buffer is there because, you know, nobody will waste food. Prices will become so high. So I think that sort of thing is going to be happening in the next 5 to 10 years, I would estimate, be my best guess, sooner than people think. And then we don't have any choice.
On the brighter side, we could experience a flowering of human knowledge and abilities unique in the history of our species. I mean, disease and aging are being approached. Maybe we'll make big progress there. A new technology makes leaps in artificial intelligence. Sure, it could kill us, but it could also make lives better for billions of people if it goes right. Maybe AI will connect and direct the carbon reduction economy. Are you open, Paul, to the possibilities of the good as well as the evil in these times?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, part of human nature, you know, part of, we were talking about how you stay sort of sane emotionally and, in light of what's happening. And I think part of the human condition is to have hope that there's, it's darkest just before the dawn sort of thing. So AI, yeah, I mean, I always kind of joke that, okay, so you get the best, we develop AI, you know, super intelligence and far outperforming, you know, human intelligence, and we put it in control of a lot of things, and we say to AI, okay, solve climate change. You know, my concern is it says basically get rid of the humans, right? So, it's hard to predict the future, right?
It may go better than we think, though, as well as worse than we think at the same time. So as an expert with 2 master's degrees and years of experience, you're a real digger and researcher. You make peanuts in donations, I'll bet, teaching the world for free. Paul, why do you do this?
I guess it's habit at this point. You know, it keeps me out of trouble. I mean, always trying to come up with some new idea or new way of communicating, you know, getting message out. And, it's like a chess puzzle. I love to play games like chess and bridge and backgammon and poker, you know, just with friends, not for cash. But, you know, it's sort of like a big puzzle. You know, how do we get out of this big hole that we've dug ourselves into? So, you know, you reach a point where you just keep going, right?
It is the biggest story never told. We're going to have to wrap it up, Paul. From Ottawa, Canada, we've been speaking with climate scientist and system scientist Paul Beckwith. And Paul has dedicated his life to educating the public on climate science. His main tools are hundreds of free videos on his YouTube channel. And he finds and interprets key breaking science for the rest of us. Paul, tell us some of the media places that people can find you.
Mostly, you know, just search for my name on YouTube. You know, if you just Google Paul Beckwith Climate Change, you can find all kinds of articles and things I've written in the past. But mostly it's through social media, on videos and on my blog and so on. So I also do work with Climate Emergency Forum, which is just basically a group of friends who, you know, we do a weekly video. We interview different people or just talk amongst ourselves. And also I do some work with another group called Facing Future, which is a video every few weeks or so on all of these topics. So it's pretty easy, I think, to find me on the web.
Okay, listeners, check out paulbeckwith.net as well, and I'll put links to everything that we've talked about here, every video and every paper we just talked about.
I mean, I'm fortunate that my name is not John Brown or Alex Smith.
Alex Smith, right? Yeah. If you Google Alex Smith, you get a football player, I think.
So I'm fortunate. So maybe you should consider changing your name if you want to get more widespread coverage, Alex.
Yeah. Thanks for talking with us, Paul.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. A feature on American News, breathless reporters announcing new records for driving and flights on the holiday weekend. 3 million people a day pass through the airports, while 38 million folks drive at least 50 miles from home. Will it be a new record? Higher than 2005? How exciting! What a great sign! The economy has recovered. Americans are confident. They have no clue. Sadly, extreme weather is causing flight cancellations and some rerouting. Should I do a special on how extreme weather is threatening the airline industry? We could get experts on. This shows how upside down our view of reality is, the extreme danger of unreality. The real story, record air travel will certainly help create not just more extreme weather, but uninhabitable and starving areas around the world. As CNN frantically described the record numbers of travelers on the road, almost 40 million Americans, they compared gas prices, talked with folks in traffic jams, and advised driving early in the morning or late at night to avoid those clogged roads. In a sign from the universe, the headline crawl below said, 6 killed in northwest India in the heat. Temperatures rise up to 122 degrees, and heat expected to last another 5 days. Perfect disconnect. Not a clue. The two stories are directly connected. We are driving poorer people into climate chaos for a holiday.
All right, bravo. One more car destroyed.
There is your tableau on live TV. Record holiday travelers, heat deaths overseas. NOAA predicts a terrible hurricane season due to the hot Atlantic. Killer tornadoes cluster in the Midwest. Straight-line winds blow out downtown towers in Houston and wind turbines. Hail on the gardens and crops. Smoke from northern forests infesting American cities from thousands of miles away. We are in the climate emergency right now, and we still don't know it. The pot is boiling, and none of us frogs feel like jumping out. Perhaps we can withdraw from this travel addiction gently, while community resources and moving family members closer together can happen. So, I propose just 2 flights per year per person. Anyone taking more than 2 flights a year receives significant penalties with community service times for repeat offenders. Exceptions would be made for essential services like an air ambulance flight crew. No exceptions for wealth. No private jets at all. Stop flying. We are wrecking the earth. Concurrent with stringent flying limits, corporations need to institute online meetings instead of travel immediately, as they did during the beginning of the COVID pandemic. Companies, not individuals, need to be given strict goals to reduce commuting and enable online work from home or local walkable, bikeable work centers. Stop burning fossil fuels to get to work. Individual cars need to become quickly a thing of the past. Shared cars and community trucks are the mid-step towards ending combustion engine transport completely. Production of combustion engines for vehicles needs to stop this year. We have billions of those motors, and each one commits to another decade or two of fossil fuel burning, which is not possible if we want a habitable world. End combustion engine production, electric engines only. The world needs to slash fossil fuel production by burning at least 10% a year less every year, starting with the countries with the highest per capita use and historic burden of carbon. And I'm sorry, but that's us. That's you, the listeners, and me. So all the developed countries go first, and they hit the hardest in reductions. If we do not cut by 10% a year, it looks like Earth will become at least 3 degrees Celsius hotter around 2100 and keep getting hotter after that. The tragic new realities at that level of warming are difficult to imagine, but it does include super cities on the coasts abandoned to the sea, along with agricultural deltas feeding hundreds of millions. It includes mass migration. It includes the limits of human survival on this planet. It includes massive floods and wildfires and the spread of tropical disease. It includes a string of societal collapses and likely civil wars or maybe gang rule. It includes a broken future where population reduction is forced by nature. That all sounds worth it, doesn't it? Chances are millions of you will soon be living in the emergency anyway, in a fossil-powered world. You may be on the wildfire alert or forced to evacuate. You may be getting out of floods or having homes torn apart by super hurricanes. Your power will go out as heat overloads the electric system. Your kids will have to stay home from school. You may have to huddle inside your home, assuming you still have one. Make sure there's room there for a few climate refugees. This is the luxurious life we pretend to conserve as we keep on polluting as normal. If you are thinking slashing reductions requires a dictatorship or nobody's going to do that, it's never going to happen, then you agree. This civilization will continue until it reaches an extinction point with generations of suffering along the way. Sign on the dotted line. You agree to damage the future to continue your present. Tell your kids and grandkids about your decision to wreck the future. Pin that declaration on your social media page and post it with your photo on a placard outside your house. I want to wreck the future. You will enter the infamous record of climate criminals, and that is your legacy. If you really don't care, if you really want to inflict suffering and death on millions of people while you make a few bucks more, be upfront about it. Tell it like you are. Harsh truths for harsh times. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get out of this climate crisis. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
You have artificial views, and the ocean comes to you. You get mental storms and broken norms to enrich the chosen few. Welcome to the future, where everything is new. But now your children have to pay.